Hello, everyone, and welcome to the ChurchLeaderInsights.com podcast. I'm Nelson Searcy, your host for these monthly podcasts focusing on church planting, church leadership, and church growth. And I'm very excited about today's podcast because we have in the studio with us my good friend Steve Stroop, who is not only the senior pastor of Lake Point Church down in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, but is also the co-author of the brand new book, Money Matters in Church, a book that I've been promoting to all of our coaching networks, as well as to many of you who have listened to these podcasts. And so, Steve, welcome to the studio.
Thanks. It's good to be with you, Nelson.
So, Steve, what's going on down in the Dallas-Fort Worth area? Lake Point Church, 28 years old, right?
Yeah, and we're having a lot of fun right now. Like a lot of churches, we're doing some multi-sites right now. Just finished up a capital campaign, not only to raise money to fund one of those multi-sites, but also a lot of it went to missions this time, which is kind of fun to be able to do that.
Good. And you came and the church was just in its infancy, and I've been there at the church the whole time. So Really led this church from just, a handful of people to...
Yeah, they had been meeting for about 5 or 6 months, running about 50 folks, and I had the privilege of coming alongside and getting to grow up with them as the church grew. I was a seminary student at the time.
Wow, and today they run about 10,000 members with adults and children's. And how many different services and locations?
We're in 12 services at six different sites, seven venues.
Wow, I think I lost count there after 12 services. And you teach how many of those live?
Only really do three live. Sometimes I do four live.
And then they're broadcast all over the different venues and locations.
Yeah, we use a video cast.
Well, some of our listeners may know that you've been a real mentor to me, a huge support to what we're doing here in New York, and I've pushed your book and given quotes that you've given me as my own, and I've taken credit for those particular quotes. But you're really a guru in a lot of ways to me as far as your leadership development stuff, and maybe we can talk about that in a future podcast. But today, we're going to really focus on this idea of money in the church, and you have a brand new book out, Money Matters in Church, and you did that with one of your elders at your church, right?
Yeah, Aubrey Malfers, who's a professor at Dallas Theological Seminary, also serves on our board, and we had the chance to do that together, so that was fun.
Yeah, so we're going to get into the Money Matters just a bit. I just want to say my thanks to Steve for being with us today, and also to say thanks for the investment he's made in the journey. I hesitate to say this on the podcast because your phone's going to be ringing off the hook, but you are our primary financial sponsor. And literally, we would not be doing what we're doing if you hadn't sponsored us. And so all the free resources that the listeners have received on church planting and the funding resources and all that, that all came out of this partnership. And so you've really made a big investment in the 2,000 or 3,000 people that will be listening to this podcast. So they may not necessarily have heard you before, but you've made a big investment in them. And so I'm excited about the investment you're going to make today, and they get to hear from you live. So let's just switch and dive in on money just a bit. I'm sure every person listening would say, this is an irrelevant topic. They have plenty of money.
Exactly.
They're over budget. And so they're probably tuning us out right now because I don't think any of us would say, oh, I wish I had another $100,000 in the coffers or whatever.
Well, if they don't need this, maybe they know somebody who does.
Maybe so. So recommend a friend.
Yeah.
And they can share this podcast with us. But let's just talk about money because we all deal with it. And probably every Monday morning, we all say, give us the attendance numbers and give us the financial numbers.
Yeah.
And so what have you done at Lake Point to just ensure financial stability over time? What are the key components of a church's look at finances?
Yeah, I think the toughest thing, Nelson, when somebody's starting a church is to figure out what our budget's going to be. And I think a lot of times we say, well, I want to have faith. And so that we pull a number out of the air and say, well, I'm going to have faith that we're going to have X amount of dollars. That's really a bad way to figure out what your budget's going to be. The biblical principle that I would allude to here is that a man doesn't go out and declare war unless he knows that he can win the battle. He doesn't start a tower unless he knows he can finish it. And both of those parables of Christ are saying to us, do your homework, crunch your numbers, and see what you've got going there. And obviously, if you're starting a church, you would look at what would be the tithing income of the core families that you have together, or your launch team, as you would say, and I would agree with that. Also, you might look at your outside support. You know, who has said, I will give money for how long? And so you've got that number. Now, once you get into starting a church, the way you would project your budget is to see what's coming in. And the truth is, until you see the numbers go up, you have to do your planning on the basis of what is currently coming in.
Now, let's just stop there, because that's really where most of our listeners are. They're either in existing churches or they're in more stable churches. And so you're saying when we start thinking about money, look at the actual week-to-week number and budget off of that number versus some number that we hope for in the coming year.
Yeah, I mean, you have to. I mean, it's the same way you do budget at home. You figure out what your income is, and that determines what kind of house you buy, what kind of car you drive. You don't start off by saying, well, let's have a wish list. Let's all get around and say, okay, kids, what size house do you want to live in, or what kind of car do you want to drive, and then try to raise that money. That's crazy, and it's just as crazy to do it in church. You know, typically when I talk to somebody on the phone that's starting a church, I'll say, well, how many are you running? And they'll say, well, I'm running 100. And I'll respond, well, then your income's about 100,000, right? Or they'll say, I'm running 250 on average attendance. And, you know, and I'll say, well, then you're, and this is adults, not your children, but just your adult attendance in your worship service. I'll say, well, you're running about 250,000. Now, that will vary, obviously, because of per capita in a particular area or stewardship, education, or anything, but that's a pretty good guess when you're first starting a church, because your finances change so rapidly because your percentage growth is so big. My suggestion is that you never have more than a six-month budget, because you don't want to be hampered by a long year-long budget if you are growing. But at the same time, you have to base your budget on what is actually coming in.
Yeah, and so that budget is kind of where you start. And then you look behind that at a number of other factors. The vision thing is something we often talk about in money. And most of the pastors listening, we're probably really good at vision when it comes to what we want to do in the community. Or maybe we're good with vision with how we want to reach the lost. But how does vision interplay with finances and budget projections and raising money?
Well, I think a lot of people think that they're going to raise more money from their people by telling the people how far behind they are. And the truth is that people do not give to a sinking ship. They give to vision. And if you can somehow tie what your people are giving to the vision, then the people can get excited about that, and they see that they can have a part in making that vision a reality, not only bringing their lost friends to church, but actually putting their money in the offering plate. And so whenever I'm writing letters to our church members or I'm doing an article on finances, I never talk that much about numbers. I talk about our vision. If we can reach this goal, or if we can bring in this much money, or if we can make our budget, then these are the lives that are going to be changed, and this is the satellite that we can start, or this is the new program that we can put together. And so it's all about vision. And so you just have to keep casting that vision and then connecting that vision to the financial resources that the people already have in their pocket.
Yeah, well, I think some of us have made that mistake in the past. I know I wrote this letter that I would rather forget that I sent out to some of our top givers and said, hey, we're $10,000 behind. Have you considered a makeup gift? And I got a little bit of money. We probably got a couple $1,000s of that $10,000, but I also got a lot of phone calls with, are we okay? Is everything okay at the church? Is the church going down? And that was just a stupid mistake that I made, because you can't sell the negative.
No, and it causes more alarm than it raises money. And I will say this, a guy can go to that well as a leader about once every 5 to 7 years. And there are times when maybe you need to do that, once 5 to 7 years. But if you go to that well more than that, people's eyes roll up in their head, and they don't give anymore, but they begin to ask questions about your leadership. Maybe we had too big of a budget. Maybe the staff didn't handle the finances well, or something like that.
So what do you think about those numbers on the board? I'm thinking about putting a big chart behind my pulpit on Sunday with
a thermometer.
Yeah, with the thermometer and my budget and how much we didn't get and passing the plate twice. So all those are bad ideas, I assume.
Well, and people, a lot of times people will run how much they need to date and how much has come in to date. And then they're running that as long as it's behind. Then they stop running that when they go ahead.
Yeah.
And they think, well, you know, if we tell them we're ahead, they'll stop giving. I don't think you ought to be given those numbers anytime. I think you ought to have a good projection on your budget, and then you ought to make that budget, and you ought to let people know that they made the budget and pat them on the back and tell them what was accomplished because they gave. And that's another thing I want to say here, Nelson, is I think a lot of guys are basing their budgets on percentages. Hmm. And percentages are the worst way to project your budget. For example, you might say, well, you know, we grew 100% last year. We were running 5 people, now we're running 10.
Yeah.
And they project that out, and they've got this unrealistic budget based on percentages. The best way to project a budget is to, in terms of your trajectory, is to look at real numbers. For example, you might have a church that from 2007 to 2008 collects $150,000 more dollars than they did the previous year. Doesn't matter what your budget was. A budget is a guess anyway. But what did you bring in more than you brought in the previous year? And if from 2006 to 2007, it was $150,000. And from 2005 to 2006, it was $150,000. In other words, for the last 3 years, you brought in $150,000 more dollars than you actually brought in the previous year. Pretty good chances next year you're going to bring in $150,000 more. And that's where I'd set my budget. You say, but we're going to do this stewardship education. We're going to cast this vision, everything. Great. When it skews up to $170,000, then you change that the following year. And if it hits $170,000 this year, it means you got $200,000 in surplus at the end of the year that you can make some one-time purchases with.
Yeah, you challenged us on that. I remember when we had a year when we grew from 300 to 500, I was like, Steve, that's a 70% increase. We went up by 70%. Should I raise my budget 70%? And you said, look back, and I think over that previous year, our giving had gone up about that much, about $125,000. And you said, well, budget off the $125,000, even though that was significantly less than 70% of our budget. So our increase was more like a 20% increase, even though we had grown by 70%. And that really kept us on solid ground financially, because we would have just been overspending the first couple of quarters of the year, and then we would have had to seriously cut the last two quarters of the year to get back on budget or to stay on track.
Yeah, you can always find more things to spend money on. And I would also say that whenever you get some big hits, like maybe somebody's aunt dies and they give a tithe of the land that they received, or somebody gets a really big bonus and it's not a regular occurrence, what you want to do is you want to use that money on a one-time purchase, because that can blow up your budget. And if the guy doesn't have the same windfall the next year, then you're really in trouble. So there's a number in my mind for our size budget that if a gift comes in and it's not a regular gift. Now, I've got a guy in my church who regularly gives a six-figure gift every year. Well, I'm going to include that in my budget. But if I get one from a guy and I haven't ever seen him before, I'm going to put that into a purchase of a sound equipment or some video or media purchase or something like that. A one-time expenditure, I'm not going to put that in my budget as well.
Yeah, that's good stuff. Now, let's just go back to the vision, and you kind of mentioned this, but how do you keep that vision before your people? What are the two or three things that you do to constantly raise the value of the vision in the area of finances?
Well, I think somebody once said that you have to say something to people seven times before they get it, and you really do have to do that. You have to preach it. You have to do some studies in your small group, and I think it's real, real important. Your small group is your best vehicle for talking about finances. I'm not one of those guys that says you can't talk about finances in your weekend service in front of seekers. In fact, a lot of times when I talk about finances on the weekend, I say, you picked a great weekend to be here, because you're going to see how much these people love you, the sacrifices that they're willing to make and to invest in this community. So I talk about it in the service, but the best place to talk about it in small groups. And I think every year you ought to have at least a four-week series in your small groups on what the Bible says about stewardship. And you come at it different ways. You can come at it from, materialism. You can come at it from the tithing standpoint of debt. There's a lot of different ways, but your people need to be taught what the Bible says about that. Another way that we cast vision on that thing is that we give every church member who joins the church the Treasure Principle by Randy Alcorn. And it's a little 45-minute read. It's real easy. And then everybody, if indeed that represents the theology of your church, everybody has a written copy, well done, of that theology. And anybody can read that. Obviously, anytime that I do a word from the pastor, I'm talking about vision. I'm talking about where we're going as a church. I'm talking about values. And somewhere in there, I'll allude to the financial support of our people. Don't hammer it, but I just will say an aside to it. And so in that written piece and the books that we give out, in the sermons that we preach, in the small groups, those would be just four of the seven ways just to begin to get that message through.
Yeah, just to give that book again to everyone who's listening, it's The Treasure Principle by Randy Alcorn. And that's a small book that you can purchase at Christian Book or any bookstore. It's a relatively inexpensive book. And you can even call some of these, like callchristianbook.com, buy copies of 50 at a time, sometimes as low as $4 or $5 a piece. And we do that to our big givers. If someone gives an exceptionally big gift, I will send them a note with the Treasure Principle. But then we also give that out to our church pretty regularly, like at membership class and some of our maturity classes, to try to keep that in the culture. And that little book is part of a much bigger book he did called Money, Possessions, and Eternity.
Which is killer.
Which I would recommend every pastor read as a theology of giving, theology of stewardship.
It is the classic on stewardship.
Now, you also do you still do the quarterly giving statements?
Yeah, we do. We will send out through our database a statement that says to people, you pledged this much for this year, and to date you've given this much. And obviously you got a lot of people who give who don't pledge, But it's important for the people who have pledged. For example, we're just finished up a capital campaign, and people made commitments of what they would give above and beyond their normal gifts to this capital campaign over the next 3 years. Well, it's going to tell them where they are on track for that, because a lot of people don't know. And before we started doing that, they would call the church office and they would say, how much have I given to date? And because they really didn't know. And the truth is, your people think they're giving more than they really are. And they get this statement and they said, well, honey, I thought you wrote a check. Well, honey, I thought you wrote the check. And so it's good to let them know how much they've given.
Yeah, that was a real challenge to me, because I had heard you only have to do the yearly giving statements, and that's what's required by law. I guess by law you have to do an annual giving statement.
It's too late once they get that one.
That's right. And I found that quarterly is good. And you know, some of the old school church growth guys even say five a year to do the one in November. That kind of breaks that up. And that's been really key for us. And it makes your people feel like they're informed. And if you do need to talk about numbers, that's a great way to kind of sneak that in there to say we're on track with budget, or, you know, we're at 50% and we're 50% of the year. And then you just cast that vision. And we always put the letter, and I think you taught us to also put a giving envelope in with that statement, so that people right there can send in their check and do their makeup tithe.
Yeah, I would do a business reply envelope, because a lot of people, they mean to get it back to you, but they can't find a stamp. So let's make it easy on them. Put that in there, and then they can ship it right back. We also do a very short one-page financial newsletter that tells them information about lives that have been changed, about designated giving that they can give. It also tells them about our audit and who audits us, and we put that in every single one of them. Yep. And so they know that we're doing things right.
Yeah. So you talked to us a little bit about budgeting and about the process and some of the pitfalls of that. You talked to us about vision. How else do you try to maintain the value of stewardship in the church and keep the church on financially stable legs?
Yeah, one of the things I want to go back in budgeting, and that is what percentage of the pie you give to different areas. And I think there's some basics, and obviously every situation is unique, but for most churches, they're going to want to spend about 50% of their general income on personnel. And you talk to 100 churches, 99 of them are spending within 1% of 50% on their personnel. Now, that will be a little heavier when you're doing a church start, because you may be using a school, and obviously you're trying to get started. So you may even be up 60, 65% in that case. And so that's the exception for church planters in terms of personnel. But for an ongoing church, about 50%. And then about 20% for facilities and your mortgage payment and that type of thing. And then you've got about 10% for missions. And then that last 20% is everything else. And there's a whole lot that has to fit into that last 20%. Your youth ministry, your children's ministry, your postage, your office machines, your phone bills, everything else. I mean, there's a whole lot that has to fit into that last 20%. And again, that will shift over time, but pretty much you can look at that. Now, here's why this is helpful. A guy's saying, I need to add a new staff member. Can I afford to add a new staff member? Well, let's just say that your personnel budget is 50% of your budget, and you know that your budget next year, based on the last 3 years, is going to go up about $100,000. And so you say, can I afford a new staff member? My answer is, if your budget's going to go up $100,000 and 50% of your budget is personnel, you got $50,000 more to spend on personnel next year. Now, that doesn't mean that you can add a $50,000 staff member, because first of all, you got to take care of your existing staff. You got to give raises, but once that's done, you look and see what's left. Let's just say, for argument's sake, that you got $30,000 left. That means you got $30,000 this year for that new staff member. So, well, I need at least 50 to add a new staff member. Well, you might not be able to add them in January, but if you've got a business year that goes from January to December, you might be in July be able to add that staff member and pick up his salary. But you also have to remember that that other portion of his salary has to be picked up the following year and is going to be out of the increase that you might have that year. And so that's a really good way. Same thing is true in terms of facilities. If 20% of your budget on average is going toward facilities, then you know if you can add a building payment or whatever. And the biggest mistakes, biggest mistake that most church planters make related to finances is because they're renting a school, they put so little of a percentage of their general budget into facilities that when they get ready to move into their first building, that they don't have enough liquidity to make the building payments. And so even if let's just say your rental of your school is only taking about 3% of your general budget, I would go ahead and be putting back at least 10 to 12% and putting that money in savings, not because of the accumulation of savings, But because you need that liquidity cash flow when you start making that first building payment, if indeed you have a permanent facility. And if you're not there right now, what you might do is just add 1 or 2% of your general budget moving over to facilities in anticipation of a building that's coming here in 2, 3, or 4 years down the road, because you can't raise enough money in a capital campaign to pay cash to move into a building.
Yeah, well, that makes a lot of sense. And that staffing thing has helped me out a lot, too. And just to clarify on that, when you say 50% of staff, you're including the whole deal, retirement, benefits, yeah, insurance, everything. And I know that's an easy mistake, because you want to put maybe the insurance over in the facility side, or maybe over in the other side. But that has to go in the staffing as well.
It really does.
So talk to us about beyond that. When people want to give in the church, you've said they don't like to give to being behind on budget. But they like to give, and people give in different ways to the church. And I know one of the things you've done is you give your people a chance to give to different areas of the church almost every week.
Yeah, I think it was John Maxwell who first came up with the concept of five pockets. And I really do believe there's at least five pockets that people will give to. And what's funny is some people will give to one of those pockets but won't give to any of the rest of them. So you better be asking for that offering. Then there's some people who will give to all five. Here's what they are. First of all, general budget. There's some folks are just rule keepers, and they're going to pay the light bills, they're going to pay the mortgage payment, they're going to pay your salary, and they don't mind. They're going to write the check, and they don't even need to know where it's going. And then you've got folks who will give to the building fund. And these are people who are kind of, I call them brick and mortar people. They want to see their gift come up out of the ground. And there are people who will give to the building fund who will not give to anything else. We just finished a capital campaign last month, and I had the largest gift in our capital campaign came from a guy who's been attending our church for 7 years and has never given a penny to our church. But when we had this capital campaign, he saw it, it caught his imagination, and he wrote out a large check to our church. And so there will be folks who will give to the building fund. The third thing people will give to is they'll give to missions. And I know there's a lot of pastors who are out there who think, well, if I give my people the opportunity to give to missions, they'll just take money that they would have given to our church and they'll give it to missions. That's not true.
It's a different pocket.
It is a different pocket. And what's fun about this is there will be people, when given the opportunity to give to missions, will learn the joy of giving and will start then giving to the general fund. Mm. And so you really help yourself when you do that. The fourth area is what I call a designated gift. And again, I think a lot of pastors are afraid of designated gifts.
Including yours truly.
Well, they are, because they think that the people will dictate where the money goes to rather than the leadership deciding how that money needs to be allotted. And here's how you overcome that, though. It's what I call directed designated giving. In other words, you create a list that says, here are some things that we need designated gifts for. We're not going to accept designated gifts for anything else. So when I send out the quarterly newsletter with the financial statements, individual financial statements, I will have a list of things that our people can give to from everything to a $50 Bible, leather-bound Bible for a new Christian that we give out to new Christians, to $50,000 for a 21-passenger van. And they pick anything between. And so here you have a guy that has two kids in your youth program, and he's also in IT professionally, and so he understands the value of technology, and he sees there that you need a $3,000 computer and software for the youth area. Man, that guy's going to be all over that. He will sit down and write you a check for $3,000, and he would never write a check for $3,000 to the general fund. Well, why wouldn't you take that money? Because you're not going to get it otherwise. And what you'd say to someone who comes and says, well, you know, I want to give $10,000 to put a flagpole at the front of the church, you just say, no, thank you. You can say no to a designated gift, but if you direct those designated gifts, what I like to do is to put things that are already in the budget in that gift. And it just means I'm going to come in on the plus and the surplus of my budget because I won't have to spend it, or I'll put something in the designated list that I know is going to be in next year's budget if we don't receive the money for it this year.
Yeah, can I just say a word about that? You taught me that principle, and we did that. We usually do it in our either second or third quarter giving letter, and I put in a half sheet of paper. I said, these are possible gifts where you can really make an investment above and beyond your normal giving. And I did that. I started with a $15 New Believer package, and I went all the way up to a $50,000 item. And the majority of the people chose the $35, $45 item. And we probably had 100 people who wanted to do something around baptisms and New Believers or something like that because they had been baptized and they had been New Believers in our church. But then we had several other people who made $1,000, $2,000, or $3,000 gifts. And they actually took that form, they circled it, they put it back in their envelope, wrote a check, and sent it into to the church. And we only had about five or six items. But that really worked out well for us. And a lot of these were people who had never given a gift of that size before. We looked at their giving. They were $2 a week people or $5 a month people, but they made a big gift of $1,000.
It allows them to tap into, allows you to tap into their passion. And people want to give toward that passion. That fifth area is the area of benevolence. And again, there are some people who just will give the last, the least, the lost, and the lonely. They're going to give to the hurting, and it's a compassion offering. And what we try to do every year, Nelson, is to get to give our people a chance to give to all of those. Now, one of the ways that we do that is on our offering envelope, they have the choice of giving to the general fund, the building fund, or the missions fund. So every time they get an envelope, they have those three choices. And we have people who will give to the building fund. They don't even know what we're building, but there's an empty blank there, and they're obsessive compulsive. They got to put something in that blank, and so they put something in there. And then on benevolence, every Christmas, we take up a benevolence offering on Christmas Eve. It's the one offering that you can take that doesn't offend lost people. It actually raises what they think about you in their eyes, that you're going to say, hey, we're taking up an offering tonight, and 100% of this offering is going to leave this place, and here's some of the places it's going to go: job training, it's going to go to pay counseling for people, it's going to pay utility bills, it's going to go to the food bank, and it's the largest offering we take every year is on Christmas Eve. And there are lost people who will sit in our service on Christmas Eve and write checks for thousands of dollars that we've never even seen before. Some of them we'll never see again. Relatives from out of town.
Yeah.
Who are impressed that we're doing something for the poor in our community that will write checks. And what has happened is we've been able to take benevolence out of our general fund. And we've not had to take up one other benevolence offering the rest of the year because of what we bring in on Christmas Eve alone.
Yeah, so let me just review those five pockets. And I think people are catching on this concept, even if it's new, that some people give out of the front pocket, which is the general fund, and they have a certain amount of money that they're going to give out of that pocket, but they've got money in the other pockets, the side pocket, the back pocket, in their pocketbooks or whatever. And so those other pockets would be the building fund. And what you're saying is that even if they exhaust what's in the general fund, they may even give more from the building fund pocket. Then there's the missions pocket, the designated gift pocket, which you're now calling directed designated giving, and then there's the benevolence pocket, which you do once a year at Christmas, and we usually put into our annual offering around Christmas as well with that. So those are the five pockets, and that's just a way for any church basically to increase their giving by 25 or even 50% without having to change a whole lot when it comes to budget or structure because you're going after those other pockets.
Yeah, and I think another thing that will help increase your giving is to send envelopes to people in the mail. Some of you already do this. You're hooked into an envelope service. Our people get three or four envelopes a month that are mailed to them, and also in that mail packet is a business reply envelope. And we just get hundreds and hundreds of our folks who are on vacation, when they're out of town, they'll still send in their gifts because we made it really easy for them to do so.
Now, I'll tell you this, and nothing that we have done has been more controversial than those envelopes.
Yeah.
Now, they're not mad at me, but people either totally love those envelopes or they just absolutely hate it. And I resisted that for a while, and you were telling me about it, and I really come to believe that it was the right thing. And when I'd been on staff at other large churches, they had done it, so I knew we had to do it eventually. And it's really cheap. I think we currently pay $7 a person per year to send these envelopes out. And people get them, and some people just love them. And they come up to you the first Sunday after they get them, "Thank you for those envelopes. That was so helpful. I used mine today." And then I would get these emails: "Take me off that list. Don't ever send me another envelope." And we just took them off the list.
Yeah.
And it was just so interesting that that little thing would make people so passionate. But we just removed them from the list, saved the $7. We kept a do not send list. And they weren't mad at us for doing it. They were just, maybe they didn't like the trees that were being wasted, or maybe they're not male people and they saw it differently. But they've never said anything about the quarterly giving. But why not send the envelopes to the people who want it? And what we did is we just sent it to everybody who had given over X amount. We said last year, if they had given $100 or more, they're going to start getting the envelopes. And then they could be taken off the list if they want to.
Yeah, and I think you have to fit your culture. You make a great point here because we send it to every single member, but we say to them in the new members workshop, we're going to do this. And
yeah.
we don't start sending it to them until we tell them that we're doing it, and we're telling them that we're going to do it for their convenience, and we give them the option to opt out if you'd rather not.
Yeah.
And so if they didn't opt out, then it's their fault, not ours.
Yeah.
And they made the choice. But every culture is different.
Yeah. Yeah, and in our more liberal culture, I think just anytime we run off a copy, and I think if we could get those envelopes printed on recycled paper, it would help. I don't know. But yeah, everybody's a little bit different when it comes to that. But I think that's a great idea. And the people who use it in our church, they just really love it. And we do that with our members and talk with them very openly about finances. Our motto these days around the journey is we report to those who support. And so we don't talk about money. Anywhere else in the church except to those people who support. And then I, of course, teach on money and do the small groups and all. Well, Steve, I can tell there's so much about this that you want to talk about. And in 25 minutes or so, I think you've given more than I've ever done in a 25-minute podcast. You're just coming out of so rapid fire. But I want to save a few minutes at the end to talk about something that I know you're heavily involved in that I have no expertise in because of my situation here in New York, but so many of our listeners do, and that is capital campaigns. And 95% of the church world, they're going to face a building at some time or another. And I may face one here in New York City at some time or another. But you've really focused in on that area. And you said this is an area where churches have a real opportunity not only to raise the level of faith in the church, but also to take the church growth and the church health to another area. So talk to us about capital campaigns.
Yeah, what a capital campaign traditionally does is it focuses in on that pocket of the building fund. Although I will say this, I'm seeing a really great movement in churches these days where they're using the same capital campaign for missions or for a new endeavor in the church. The capital campaign that we're in right now, only 50% of it went actually to buildings. 20% of it went to missions.
Yeah.
And the remainder of it went to new initiatives of new ministries that we wanted to start, and we needed some seed money to do that. And so really you could use a capital campaign for anything. But traditionally, we think of it in regards to a building campaign. And most of them look like this. We come to our folks and we say, hey, we need to really do something big here. We need to take a huge step that our general fund will not allow us to do. And so we're going to ask you to consider making a one-time gift and then pledging what you'd be willing to give over the next 3 years above and beyond your normal gifts. And many times when you come to your people in a capital campaign like this, you're really saying to them, we want you to make a gift of a lifetime, a one-time gift of a lifetime, and then to make some real sacrifices these next 3 years, maybe delay upgrading your house or maybe delay upgrading your car or remodeling your kitchen. In other words, if you believe in what we're doing, we need all hands on deck to do sacrificial giving above and beyond what you would normally give in a church. And that's pretty much it. And you take about 10 weeks to present the needs to your people, to have them pray about it, for you to do some one-on-one meetings with those folks. And it culminates with typically an in-gathering day where you invite all your people to come and bring their pledges and their commitments.
Yeah, well, this is a huge pressure point in the life of churches. And so many pastors are just afraid of this. And you've been sort of on a mission the last several years to really help pastors at this critical time. And you developed a number of resources. Like in your book, for example, I think you've got one of the most helpful sections on capital campaigns that I've ever seen in print. And some of the real, high D type A kind of personalities, they'll take what's in the book, and that's the last little piece of the puzzle that they need to go do their own capital campaign. So you can learn more about this in the book, but you've also gone beyond that. You do some consulting with churches, and you have a whole day seminar that you offer as a resource to churches.
Yeah, from time to time, about once a year, we'll do a seminar on how to have your own capital campaign, and we'll take a full day and basically walk people through how to do each part of that. And I really do believe that there are some people who are gifted enough that they can do their own capital campaign. They can go to the seminar, they can use the notebook which we provide. It gives you the letters to send, it gives you suggestions about what goes in your publications, gives you a calendar that you can work through and do all that. For those who do not feel like they can do that on their own, I also do provide consulting, like some of the other firms like the Enjoy and RSI and that kind of thing. It's the same basic program. I will say that for most people, they need to use either a consultant like myself or they need to use one of the companies out there for the first time.
Yeah, and I would highly agree with that. Even if you're kind of one of these do-it-yourself church planner type folks, there's no way I would do a $2 million or even a $5 or $10 million capital campaign by myself. I don't have time to make those kind of mistakes, and I need to make sure we do everything right so we can hit our goal because it's just so important. And I would say this, I would definitely not personally do my own capital campaign. I would tap you or one of the other resources. Now, in my case, I would try to tap you because of you meet a bias that I have strongly in this area, which is you're a practitioner. And I would just say to those who are listening, there's a lot of people you can use to do a capital campaign, but why not use a pastor who's done it? And I know I'm putting you on the spot here, Steve. I can tell you're just slightly uncomfortable with this line of questioning I'm going down. But, I mean, you're still living it. You're still in the mix. And I say almost every month to guys who listen to this podcast, you know, when you buy a book by a practitioner. It's good to read about theory. It's good to read about someone who's studying other people. But given the choice, I want to read by the guy who's done it. And that's what I love. How many capital campaigns now have you done at Lake Point?
Well, we've just finished our 10th capital campaign. I have a little bit of a different theory than most guys. Most guys would like to go 5, 6, 7 years and then have a capital campaign, give their people a quote-unquote a rest. And I really believe that once your people get a capital campaign mentality and they get it in their budget, why pull it out of their budget and then have to work so hard to get it back in? Now, I will say this. If you do back-to-back campaigns, you will not raise as much money as if you wait 4 or 5 years. But I think over the long period, or you look over 3 decades, you're going to end up raising a lot more money by doing back-to-back and each time raising a little less money in terms of times your annual income than if you just did it 2 or 3 times during that. Going back to using outside expertise, what a lot of guys don't understand is that when you use an outside consultant, is what you're paying for is not even so much the effort that those people are giving you, you're paying for knowledge. And guys who are doing it on a regular basis are learning some tricks, they're learning some nuances that really, literally will save you hundreds of thousands of dollars that will cause you to raise hundreds and thousands of more dollars. And so I suggest that you use a consultant of some kind the first time, but the whole premise of my book and the premise of a DVD resource that we're providing through you guys, Nelson, is that once you've done it with an outside consultant once, you really can do it yourself. There's some basic things that if you do and you do them well, you're going to have a great capital campaign.
Yeah, so I just tell people about those resources. First is the book, Money Matters in Church, written by Steve Stroop and Aubrey Malfers. You can find that just below the podcast. You can find a link on our website, or you can purchase it on Amazon or probably any bookstore nearby, published by Baker Books. That's a great resource just to give you more on all different aspects of money in the church, as well as a whole section on capital campaigns. Then beyond that, for those who may have already done a capital campaign, or maybe those who have some experience with that, you might want to pick up Steve's one-day DVD resource. And this is a seminar that you normally do for $1,000 a person. And then you guys have now recorded that, and you're selling it at a good bit less than that. And we have that available on our website, and you can buy that just below the podcast as well. Just click on the link to learn more about that. It's an all-day seminar with DVDs, fill-in-the-blank notes. Just there's so much learning. The value of this resource is so beyond the price you're going to pay. And so some of you might want to pick that up. And then some may want to consider Steve as the consultant. And you only do a few of these because you are still teaching the majority of the time at your place, and you're in the mix of leading capital campaigns. But you take a couple of clients a year, I believe. Yeah. And if you're interested in that, just give our office a call at 1-800-264-5129, and we'll get you hooked up with Steve and get you in that process if you want him to do your capital campaign. And I want to put my name in for when we get ready to do the capital campaign here in Manhattan. And you've already promised me that you can help me raise $50 million.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I can buy a 3,000 seat auditorium in downtown Manhattan. So
exactly.
I'm in the loop with this. But if that's of interest to you, I hope you'll give us a call. Now, there's so much more on money, and so, Steve, maybe we can come back sometime in the future and talk, but as you look over your list of bullet points and the things you wanted to share with our audience, is there anything you want to leave? I'll kind of give you the final word here.
Yeah, I think a huge word here is integrity. The number one word that was Googled last year was the word integrity, and we really just need to understand that we need to be really transparent with our people. We need to give them clear answers. We need to let them know we're being audited. We need to let them know that we're handling their money well, that we're making it go a great distance. We're getting bang for their bucks in terms of our vision, in terms of our purpose, that we really are making disciples, and that we're being good stewards. And I think that's the one thing more than anything that will set funds free in your ministry is for your people to trust you. It's all about trust, and it's about trust in the leadership. And so I think if we communicate well, if we teach what the Bible teaches about it, if we're transparent in how we're doing business, you won't have any really true financial problems.
Great. Well, Steve, thanks for being with us today. And that's certainly our prayer for everyone who listens, that they operate with financial integrity. And thanks for sharing what you've learned over the last 28 years at Lake Point and how exciting there it is in Rockwall, Texas, on the east side of the Dallas area, where God's just doing amazing things through you and the multi-site churches. And so thanks for sharing your wisdom with us. Thanks for sharing the book with us, Money Matters in Church. And then we're just look forward to maybe continuing this dialogue at a future time. And we're talking with Steve about other resources that he's going to make available to the Church Leader Insights audience. And so we'll tell you about those as they come down to the pike. And Steve, thanks for being with us. And thanks to everyone who's listening. And we'll see you back next month for ChurchLeaderInsights.com podcast.